Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The Piazza by Herman Melville. With fairest flowers, whilst summer lasts, and I live here, Fidella. When I removed into the country, it was to occupy an old-fashioned farmhouse which had no piazza, a deficiency the more regretted because not only did I like piazzas, as somehow combining the coziness of indoors with the freedom of outdoors, and it is so pleasant to inspect your thermometer there, but the country round about was such a picture that in berry time no boy climbs hill or crosses vale without coming upon easels planted in every nook and sunburnt painters painting there. A very paradise of painters. The circle of the stars cut by the circle of the mountains, at least so it looks from the house, though once upon the mountains no circle of them can you see. Had the site been chosen 5 rods off, this charmed ring would not have been. The house is old. 70 years since, from the heart of the Hearthstone Hills, they quarried the Kaaba, or holy stone, to which each Thanksgiving the social pilgrims used to come. So long ago that in digging for the foundation the workmen used both spade and axe fighting the troglodytes of those subterranean parts, sturdy roots of sturdy wood, encamped upon what is now a long landslide of sleeping meadow, sloping away off from my poppy bed. Of that knit wood but one survivor stands, an elm, lonely through steadfastness. Whoever built the house, he builded better than he knew, or else Orion in the zenith flashed down his Damocles sword to him some starry night and said, "Build there!" For how otherwise could it have entered the builder's mind that upon the clearing being made, such a purple prospect would be his, nothing less than Greylock, with all his hills about him, like Charlemagne among his peers. Now for a house so situated in such a country, to have no piazza for the convenience of those who might desire to feast upon the view, and take their time and ease about it, seemed as much of an omission as if a picture gallery would have no bench, for what but picture galleries are the marble halls of these same limestone hills? Galleries hung month after month anew, with pictures ever fading into pictures ever fresh. And beauty is like piety. You cannot run and read it. Tranquility and constancies with nowadays an easy chair are needed. For though of old when reverence was in vogue and indolence was not, the devotees of nature, doubtless, used to stand and adore, just as in the cathedrals of those ages the worshippers of a higher power did, yet in these times of failing faith and feeble knees we have the piazza and the pew. During the first year of my residence, the more leisurely to witness the coronation of Charlemagne, weather permitting, they crown him every sunrise and sunset, I chose me, on the hillside bank nearby, a royal lounge of turf, a green velvet lounge with long moss-padded back, while at the head, strangely enough, there grew, but, I suppose for heraldry, 3 tufts of blue violets and a field argent of wild strawberries, and a trellis with honeysuckle I set for canopy. Very majestical lounge indeed, so much so that here, as with reclining majesty of Denmark and his orchard, a sly earache invaded me. But if damps abound at times in Westminster Abbey, because it's so old, why not within this monastery of mountains, which is older? A piazza must be had. The house was wide, my fortune narrow, so that to build a panoramic piazza, one round and round, it could not be, although, indeed, considering the matter by rule and square, the carpenters, in the kindest way, were anxious to gratify my furthest wishes, as I've forgotten how much afoot. Upon but one of the 4 sides would prudence grant me what I wanted. Now, which side? To the east, that long camp of the Hearthstone Hills, fading far away towards Quito, and every fall a small white flake of something peering suddenly of a coolish morning from the topmost cliff, the season's new-dropped lamb, its earliest fleece, and then the Christmas dawn draping those dun highlands with red-barred plaids and tartans, Goodly sight from your piazza, that. Goodly sight, but to the north is Charlemagne. Can't have the Hearthstone Hills with Charlemagne. Well, the south side, apple trees are there. Pleasant of a balmy morning in the month of May to sit and see that orchard, white-budded as for a bridal. And in October one green arsenal yard. Such piles of ruddy shot. Very fine, I grant, but to the north is Charlemagne. The west side, look, an upland pasture, allying away into Maplewood atop. Sweet in opening spring to trace upon the hillside, otherwise gray and bare, to trace, I say, the oldest pass by their streaks of earliest green. Sweet indeed, I can't deny, but to the north is Charlemagne. So Charlemagne, he carried it. It was not long after 1848, and, somehow, about that time, all round the world, these kings, they had the casting vote and voted for themselves. No sooner was ground broken than all the neighborhood, neighbor Dives in particular, broke, too, into a laugh. Piazza to the north! Winter piazza! Wants of winter midnights to watch the aurora borealis, I suppose. Hope he's laid in good store of polar muffs and mittens. That was in the lion month of March. Not forgotten are the blue noses of the carpenters, and how they scouted at the greenness of the cit, who would build his sole piazza to the north. But March don't last forever. Patience, and August comes. And then in the cool Elysium of my northern bower, I, Lazarus in Abraham's bosom, cast down the hill a pitying glance on poor old Dives, tormented in the purgatory of his piazza to the south. But even in December, this northern piazza does not repel. Nipping cold and gusty though it be, and the north wind, like any miller, bolting by the snow, in finest flower, for then, once more, with frosted beard, I pace the sleety deck, weathering Cape Horn. In summer, too, Canute-like, sitting here, one is often reminded of the sea, for not only do long ground-swells roll the slanting grain, and little wavelets of the grass ripple over upon the low piazza as their beach, and the blown down of dandelions is wafted like the spray, and the purple of the mountains is just the purple of the billows, and a still August noon broods upon the deep meadows as a calm upon the line. But the vastness and the lonesomeness are so oceanic, and the silence and the sameness too, that the first peep of a strange house, rising beyond the trees, is for all the world like spying on the Barbary coast an unknown sail. And this recalls my inland voyage to Fairyland, a true voyage, but take it all in all, interesting as if invented. From the piazza, some uncertain object I had caught, mysteriously snugged away, to all appearance, in a sort of purple breast pocket, high up in a hopper-like hollow, or sunken angle among the northwestern mountains, yet whether really it was on a mountainside or a mountain top could not be determined, because though viewed from favorable points, a blue summit, peering up away behind the rest, will, as it were, talk to you over their heads and plainly tell you that though he, the blue summit, seems among them, he is not of them, God forbid, and indeed would have you know that he considers himself, as to say truth, he has good right, by several cubits their superior. Nevertheless, certain ranges, here and there double-filed as in platoons, so shoulder and follow up upon one another with their irregular shapes and heights, that from the piazza a nigher and lower mountain will in most states of the atmosphere effacingly shade itself away into a higher and further one, that an object bleak on the former's crest will for all that appear nested in the latter's flank. These mountains, somehow, they play at hide-and-seek and all before one's eyes. But be that as it may, the spot in question was, at all events, so situated as to be only visible, and then but vaguely, under certain witching conditions of light and shadow. Indeed, for a year or more, I knew not there was such a spot, and might perhaps have never known had it not been for a wizard afternoon in autumn, late in autumn, a mad poet's afternoon, when the turned maple woods in the broad basin below me, having lost their first vermilion tint, dully smoked like smoldering towns when flames expire upon their prey, and rumor had it that this smokiness in the general air was not all Indian summer, which was not used to be so sick a thing, however mild, but in great part was blown from far-off forests for weeks on fire in Vermont, so that no wonder the sky was ominous as Hecate's cauldron, and two sportsmen crossing a red stubble buckwheat field seemed guilty Macbeth and foreboding Banquo, and the hermit's son hutted in an adullam cave well toward the south according to his season, did little else but by indirect reflection of narrow ways shot down a Simplon pass among the clouds, just steadily paint one small round strawberry mole upon the wan cheek of northwestern hills, signal as a candle, one spot of radiance where all else was shade. Fairies there, thought I, some haunted ring where fairies dance. Time passed in the following May, after a gentle shower upon the mountains, a little shower islanded in misty seas of sunshine, such a distant shower, and sometimes two and three and four of them, all visible together in different parts, as I love to watch from the piazza, instead of thunderstorms as I used to, which wrap old Greylock like a Sinai, till one thinks swart Moses must be climbing among scathed hemlocks there. After, I say, that gentle shower, I saw a rainbow resting its further end just where, in autumn, I had marked the mole. Fairies there, I thought I, remembering that rainbows bring out the blooms, and that if one can but get to the rainbow's end, his fortune is made in a bag of gold. Yon rainbow's end, were I were there, thought I, and nonetheless I wished it, for now first noticing what seemed some sort of glen or grotto in the mountainside, at least whatever it was, viewed through the rainbow's medium, it glowed like the Potosi mine. But a workaday neighbor said no doubt it was but some old barn, an abandoned one, its broadside beaten in, the acclivity its background. But I, though I had never been there, I knew better. A few days after, a cheery sunrise kindled a golden sparkle in the same spot as before. The sparkle was of that vividness, it seemed as if it could only come from glass. The building, then, if building after all it was, could at least not be a barn, much less an abandoned one, stale hay 10 years musting in it. No, if aught built by mortal, it must be a cottage, perhaps long vacant and dismantled, but this very spring magically fitted up and glazed. Again one noon in the same direction I marked, over dimmed tops of terraced foliage, a broader gleam, as of a silver buckler, held sunwards over some croucher's head, which gleam experiences in like cases taught must come from a roof newly shingled. This to me made pretty sure the recent occupancy of that far cot in fairyland. Day after day now, full of interest in my discovery, what time I could spare from reading the Midsummer Night's Dream and all about Titania, wishfully I gazed off towards the hills, but in vain. Either troops of shadows, an imperial guard, with slow pace and solemn defiled along the steeps, or routed by pursuing light, fled broadcast from east to west, old wars of Lucifer and Michael, or the mountains, though unvexed by these mirrored sham fights in the sky, had an atmosphere otherwise unfavorable for fairy views. I was sorry, the more so because I had to keep my chamber for some time after, which chamber did not face those hills. At length, when pretty well again, and sitting out in the September morning upon the piazza, and thinking to myself when, just after a little flock of sheep, the farmer's banded children passed a-nutting and said, "How sweet a day!" It was, after all, but what their fathers call a weather-breeder, and indeed was become so sensitive through my illness as that I could not bear to look upon a Chinese creeper of my adoption, and which, to my delight, climbing a post of the piazza, had burst out in starry bloom. But now, if you remove the leaves a little, showed millions of strange cankerous worms, which, feeding upon those blossoms, so shared their blessed hue as to make it unblessed evermore, worms whose germs had doubtless lurked in the very bulb which so hopefully I had planted. In this ingrate peevishness of my weary convalescence was I sitting there, when suddenly looking off I saw the golden mountain window, dazzling like a deep-sea dolphin. Fairies there, thought I, once more, the queen of fairies at her fairy window, at any rate some glad mountain girl. It will do me good. It will cure this weariness to look on her. No more. I'll launch my yawl. Ho, cheerily, heart! And push away for fairyland, for rainbow's end, in fairyland. How to get to fairyland, by what road, I did not know, nor could anyone inform me, not even one Edmund Spencer, who had been there, so he wrote me, further than that to reach fairyland. It must be voyaged to, and with faith. I took the fairy mountain's bearings, and the first fine day, when strength permitted, got into my yawl, highly pommeled leather one, cast off the fast, and away I sailed, free voyager as an autumn leaf. Early dawn, in sallying westward, I sowed the morning before me. Some miles brought me nigh the hills, but out of present sight of them. I was not lost, for roadside goldenrods, as guideposts, pointed. I doubted not the way to the golden window. Following them, I came to a lone and languid region where the grass-grown ways were travelled but by drowsy cattle, that, less waked than stirred by day, seemed to walk and sleep. Browse they did not. The enchanted never eat. At least so says Don Quixote, the sagest sage that ever lived. On I went and gained at last the fairy mountain's base, but saw yet no fairy ring. A pasture rose before me, letting down five mouldering bars, so moistly green they seemed fished up from some sunken wreck, a wigged old Ares, long-visaged and with crumpled horn, came snuffing up, and then retreating decorously led on along a milky way of white weed, past dim clustering Pleiades and Hyades of small forget-me-nots, and would have led me further still his astral path but for golden flights of yellow birds, pilot surely to the golden window, to one side flying before me, from bush to bush towards deep woods, which woods themselves were luring, and somehow lured too by their fence, banning a dark road, which, however dark, led up. I pushed through, when Ares, renouncing me now for some lost soul, wheeled and went his wiser way, forbidding and forbidden ground to him. A winter wood road, matted all along with winter green, by the side of pebbly waters, waters the cheerier for their solitude, beneath swaying fir boughs, petted by no season, but still green in all, on I journeyed, my horse and I, on by an old sawmill, bound down and hushed with vines, that his grating voice no more was heard, on by a deep flume clove through snowy marble, vernal-tinted, where freshet eddies had, on each side, spun out of empty chapels in the living rock, on where Jackson the pulpit, like their Baptist namesake, preached but to the wilderness, on where huge cross-grained block, fern-bedded, showed where, in forgotten times, man after man had tried to split it, but lost his wedges for his pains, which wedges yet rusted in their holes. On, where ages passed, and step-like ledges of a cascade, skull-hollow pots had been churned out by ceaseless whirling of a flintstone, ever-wearing, but itself unworn. On, by wild rapids pouring into a secret pool, but soothed by circling there a while, issued forth serenely. On, to less broken ground, and by a little ring, where truly fairies must have danced, or else some wheel-tire been heated, for all was bare, still on and up and out into a hanging orchard, where maidenly looked down upon me a crescent moon from morning. My horse hitched low his head, red apples rolled before him, Eve's apples, seek no furthers. He tasted one, I another, it tasted of the ground. Fairyland not yet, thought I, flinging my bridle to a humped old tree, that crooked out an arm to catch it, for the way now lay where path was none, and none might go but by himself, and only go by daring, through blackberry brakes that tried to pluck me back, though I but strained towards fruitless growths of mountain laurel, up slippery steeps to barren heights where stood none to welcome. Fairyland not yet, thought I, though the morning is here before me. Foot-sore enough and weary, I gained not then my journey's end, but came ere long to a craggy pass, dipping towards growing regions still beyond, A zigzag road, half overgrown with blueberry bushes, here turned among the cliffs. A rent was in their ragged sides. Through it a little track branched off, which upwards threading that short defile came breezily out above to where the mountain top, part sheltered northward by a taller brother, sloped gently off a space, air darkly plunging, and here, among fantastic rocks, reposing in a herd, the foot track wound, half beaten, up to a little low-storied grayish cottage, capped, nun-like, with a peaked roof. On one slope the roof was deeply weather-stained, and nigh the turfy eaves trough all velvet-napped. No doubt the snail-monks founded mossy priories there. The other slope was newly shingled. On the north side, doorless and windowless, the clapboards, innocent of paint, were yet green as the north side of lichened pines, or copperless hulls of Japanese junks, becalmed. The whole base, like those of the neighboring rocks, was rimmed about with shaded streaks of richest sod, for with hearthstones in fairyland, the natural rock, though housed, preserves to the last, just as in open fields, its fertilizing charm. Only by necessity working now at a remove to the sward without, so at least says Oberon, grave authority in fairy lore. Though setting Oberon aside, certain it is that even in the common world, the soil, close up to farmhouses, as close up to pasture rocks is, even though untended, ever richer than it is a few rods off, such gentle nurturing heat is radiated there. But with this cottage, the shaded streaks were richest in its front and about its entrance, where the ground sill, and especially the door sill, had, through long eld, quietly settled down. No fence was seen, no enclosure. Nearby, ferns, ferns, ferns. Further, woods, woods, woods. Beyond, mountains, mountains, mountains. Then, sky, sky, sky. Turned out an aerial commons, pasture for the mountain moon. Nature, and but nature, house and all, even a low cross pile of silver birch, piled openly to season, up among those silvery sticks, as through the fencing of some sequestered grave, spring vagrant raspberry bushes, willful asserters of their right of way. The foot track, so dainty narrow, just like a sheep track, led through long ferns that lodged. Fairyland at last, thought I. Una and her lamb dwell here. Truly a small abode. Mare Palaquin, set down on the summit in a pass between two worlds, participant of neither. A sultry hour, and I wore a light hat of yellow sinnet with white duck trousers, both relics of my tropic sea-going. Clogged in the muffling ferns, I softly stumbled, staining the knees a sea-green. Pausing at the threshold, or rather where threshold once had been, I saw through the open doorway a lonely girl sewing at a lonely window, a pale-cheeked girl and a fly-specked window with wasps about the mended upper panes. I spoke. She shyly started, like some Tahiti girl, secreted for a sacrifice, first catching sight through palms of Captain Cook. Recovering, she bade me enter, with her apron brushed off, a stool, then silently resumed her own. With thanks I took the stool, but now for a space I too was mute. This, then, is a fairy mountain house, and here the fairy queen sitting at her fairy window. I went up to it. Downwards, directed by the tunneled pass as through a level telescope, I caught sight of a far-off, soft, azure world. I hardly knew it, though I came from it. "You must find this view very pleasant," said I at last. "Oh, sir," tears starting in her eyes, "the first time I looked out of this window, I said, never, never shall I weary of this." "And what wearies you of it now?" "I don't know," while a tear fell, "but it is not the view, it is Mariana." Some months back, her brother, only 17, had come hither, a long way from the other side, to cut wood and burn coal, and she, elder sister, had accompanied him. Long had they been orphans, and now sole inhabitants of the sole house upon the mountain. No guest came, no traveller passed. The zigzag perilous road was only used at seasons by the coal wagons. The brother was absent the entire day, sometimes the entire night. When at evening, fagged out, he did come home, he soon left his bench, poor fellow, for his bed, just as one at last wearily quits that too for still deeper rest, the bench, the bed, the grave. Silent I stood by the fairy window while these things were being told. "Do you know," she said at last, as stealing from her story, "do you know who lives yonder? I have never been down into that country, way off there, I mean, that house, that marble one, pointing far across the lower landscape. Have you not caught it? There on the long hillside, the field before, the woods behind, the white shines out against their blue. Don't you mark it? The only house in sight." I looked, and after a time, to my surprise, recognized, more by its position than its aspect, or Mariana's description, my own abode, glimmering much like this mountain one from the piazza. The mirage haze made it appear less a farmhouse than King Charming's palace. I have often wondered who lives there, but it must be some happy one. Again this morning was I thinking so. "Some happy one," returned I, starting. "And why do you think that? You judge some rich one lives there?" "Rich or not, I never thought, but it looks so happy, I can't tell how, and it is so far away. Sometimes I think I do, but dream it is there. You should see it in a sunset." "No doubt the sunset gilds it finely, but not more than the sunrise does this house, perhaps." "This house? The sun is a good sun, but it never gilds this house. Why should it? This old house is rotting. That makes it so mossy. In the morning the sun comes in at this old window, to be sure, boarded up when first we came, a window I can't keep clean, do what I may, and half burns and nearly blinds me at my sewing, besides setting the flies and wasps astir. Such flies and wasps as only lone mountain houses know. See, here is the curtain, this apron. I try to shut it out with them. It fades it, you see. Sun gild this house? Not that ever Mariana saw. Because when this roof is gilded most, then you stay here within. The hottest, weariest hour of day, you mean? Sir, the sun gilds not this roof. It leaks so, brother newly shingled all one side. Did you not see it? The north side, where the sun strikes most on what the rain has wetted. The sun is a good sun, but this roof, it first scorches and then rots. An old house. They went west and are long dead, they say. Who built it? A mountain house. In winter no fox could den in it. That chimney place has been blocked up with snow just like a hollow stump. Yours are strange fancies, Mariana. They but reflect the things. Then I should have said, these are strange things rather than yours are strange fancies. As you will, and took up her sewing. Something in those quiet words or in that quiet act, it made me mute again, while noting, through the fairy window, a broad shadow stealing on, as cast by some gigantic condor, floating at brooding poise on outstretched wings. I marked how, by its deeper and inclusive dusk, it wiped away into itself all lesser shades of rock or fern. "You watch the clouds," said Mariana. "No, a shadow, a cloud's no doubt, though that I cannot see. How did you know it? Your eyes are on your work." "It dusked my work. There, now the cloud is gone. Trey comes back." "How?" "The dog, the shaggy dog. At noon he steals off of himself to change his shape, returns and lies down a while, nigh the door. Don't you see him? His head is turned round at you, though when you came he looked before him." "Your eyes rest but on your work? What do you speak of?" "By the window, crossing." "You mean the shaggy shadow, the nigh one? And yes, now that I mark it, it is not unlike a large black Newfoundland dog. The invading shadow gone, the invaded one returns. But I do not see what casts it." "For that you must go without. One of those grassy rocks, no doubt. You see his head, his face? The shadows? You speak as if you saw it, and all the time your eyes are on your work. Trey looks at you, still without glancing up. This is his hour. I see him." "Have you then so long sat at this mountain window, where but clouds and vapors pass, that to you shadows are as things, though you speak of them as of phantoms, that by familiar knowledge, working like a second sight, you can, without looking for them, tell just where they are, though as having mice-like feet they creep about and come and go, that to you these lifeless shadows are as living friends, who, though out of sight or not out of mind, even in their faces, is it so? That way I never thought of it, but the friendliest one, that used to soothe my weariness so much, coolly quivering on the ferns, it was taken from me, never to return, as Trey did just now. The shadow of a birch. The tree was struck by lightning, and brother cut it up. You saw the cross-pile outdoors. The buried root lies under it, but not the shadow. That has flown and never will come back, nor ever anywhere stir again. Another cloud here stole along, once more blotting out the dog and blackening all the mountain, while the stillness was so still. Deafness might have forgot itself, or else believed that noiseless shadow spoke. Birds, Mariana, singing birds, I hear none. I hear nothing. Boys and bobolinks, do they never come a-berrying up here? Birds I seldom hear, boys never. The berries mostly ripe and fall, few but me the wiser. But yellow birds showed me the way, part way at least, and then flew back. I guess they play about the mountainside, but don't make the top their home. And no doubt you think that, living so lonesome here, knowing nothing, hearing nothing, little at least, but sound of thunder and the fall of trees, never reading, seldom speaking, yet ever wakeful, this is what gives me my strange thoughts, for so you call them, this weariness and wakefulness together. Brother who stands and works in open air, would I could rest like him, but mine is mostly but dull woman's work, sitting, sitting, restless sitting. But do you not go walk at times? These woods are wide. And lonesome, lonesome because so wide. Sometimes, 'tis true, of afternoons I go a little way, but soon come back again. Better feel lone by hearth than rock. The shadows hereabouts I know, those in the woods are strangers. But the night? Just like the day, thinking, thinking. A wheel I cannot stop, pure want of sleep it is that turns it. I have heard that for this wakeful weariness to say one's prayers and then lay one's head upon a fresh hop pillow. Look! Through the fairy window she pointed down the steep to a small garden patch nearby, mere pot of rifled loam, half rounded in by sheltering rocks, where side by side, some feet apart, nipped and puny, two hop vines climbed two poles, and gaining their tip ends would have then joined over in an upward clasp, but the baffled shoots, groping a while in empty air, trailed back whence they sprung. You have tried the pillow, then? Yes. And prayer? Prayer and pillow. Is there no other cure or charm? Oh, if I could but once get to yonder house, and but look upon whoever the happy being is that lives there. A foolish thought. Why do I think it? Is it that I live so lonesome and know nothing? I too know nothing, and therefore cannot answer, but for your sake, Mariana, well could wish that I were that happy one of the happy house you dream you see, for then you would behold him now, and as you say, this weariness might leave you. Enough. Launching my yawl no more for fairyland, I stick to the piazza. It is my box royal, and this amphitheatre, my theatre of San Carlo. Yes, the scenery is magical, the illusion so complete. And Madame Meadowlark, my prima donna, plays her grand engagement here, and drinking in her sunrise note, which Memnon-like seems struck from the golden window, how far from me the weary face behind it. But every night when the curtain falls, truth comes in with darkness. No light shows from the mountain. To and fro I walk the piazza deck, haunted by Mariana's face, and many as real a story. And that story was The Piazza by Herman Melville from Great Short Stories of the Masters, edited by Charles Nieder. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. The End of Candia by Gabriel D'Annunzio. 1. 3 days after the Easter banquet, which was traditionally a great occasion in the La Monica household, both in its lavishness and in the number of its guests, Donna Christina La Monica was counting the table linen and silver service and replacing them one by one methodically in drawer and cupboard in readiness for future banquets. As usual, she had with her to help in the task the chambermaid Maria Basaccia and the laundress Candida Marcanda, familiarly known as Candia. The huge hampers filled with fine linen stood in a row upon the floor. The silver platters and other table service gleamed brightly from the sideboard, massive vessels, somewhat crudely wrought by rustic silversmiths, and of more or less liturgical design, like all the plate which rich provincial families hand down from generation to generation. A fresh fragrance of soapy water pervaded the room. From the hampers, Candia took tablecloths, napkins, and towels. She made the mistress take note that each piece was intact, and then passed them over to Maria, who laid them away in the drawers, while the mistress sprinkled lavender between them and entered the numbers in a book. Candia was a tall, lean, angular woman of 50, with back somewhat bent from the habitual attitude of her calling, with arms of unusual length and the head of a bird of prey mounted on a turtle's neck. Maria Basaccia was a native of Ortona, a trifle stout, with a fresh complexion and the clearest of eyes. She had a soft fashion of speech and the light, leisurely touch of one whose hands were almost always busy over cakes and syrups, pastries and preserves. Donna Cristina, also an Ortonese and educated in a Benedictine convent, was of small stature, with a somewhat too generous expanse of bosom, a face overstrewn with freckles, a large, long nose, poor teeth, and handsome eyes cast downward in a way that made one think of a priest in woman's clothing. The three women were performing their task with the utmost care, giving up to it the greater part of the afternoon. All at once, just as Candia was leaving with the empty baskets, Donna Cristina, in the course of counting the small silver, found that a spoon was missing. "Maria, Maria," she cried in utter dismay, "count these. There's a spoon missing. Count them yourself." "But how could it? That's impossible, Signora," replied Maria. "Let me have a look." And she in turn began to count the small pieces, telling off the numbers aloud, while Donna Cristina looked on, shaking her head. The silver gave forth a clear, ringing sound. "Well, it's a fact," Maria exclaimed at last with a gesture of despair. "What's to be done about it?" She herself was safe from all suspicion. For 15 years she had given proofs of her fidelity and honesty in this very household. She had come from Ortona together with Donna Cristina at the time of the wedding, almost as though she were a part of the marriage settlement, and from the first she had acquired a certain authority in the house, through the indulgence of her mistress. She was full of religious superstitions, devoted to the saint in the belfry of her birthplace, and possessed of great shrewdness. She and her mistress had formed a sort of offensive alliance against Pescara and all pertaining to it, and more particularly against the saint of the Pecorisi. She never missed a chance to talk of her native town, to vaunt its beauty and its riches, the splendor of its basilica, the treasures of San Tommaso, the magnificence of its religious ceremonies, as compared with the poverty of San Citeo that possessed only one single little silver cross. Donna Cristina said, "Take a good look in there." Maria left the room to extend the search. She explored every nook and corner of the kitchen and the balcony, but in vain. She came back empty-handed. "It isn't there! It isn't there!" Then the two together tried to think, to make conjectures, to ransack their memories. They went out upon the balcony that communicated with the court, the balcony back of the laundry, to make one last research. As they talked together in loud tones, women's heads began to appear at the windows of the surrounding houses. "What has happened, Donna Cristina? Tell us about it." Donna Cristina and Maria related the occurrence with many words and many gestures. "Lord, Lord, then there have been thieves here?" In a moment the report of the theft had spread through the neighborhood, through all Pescara. Men and women fell to discussing, to imagining who could have been the thief. By the time the news had reached the most distant houses of Sant'Agostino, it had gathered volume. It was no longer a question of a mere spoon, but of all the silver plate in the house of La Monica. Now, since the weather was fine and roses were beginning to bloom upon the balcony and a pair of linnets were singing in their cage, the women lingered at their windows for the pleasure of gossiping across the grateful warmth of the outdoor air. Female heads continued to appear from behind the pots of sweet basil, and a chatter arose that must have rejoiced the cats upon the housetops. Clasping her hands, Donna Christina asked, "Who could it have been?" Donna Isabella Sertale, nicknamed the polecat, who had the lithe and stealthy movements of a beast of prey, asked in a strident voice, "Who did you have with you, Donna Christina? It seems to me that I saw Candia on her way." "Aha!" exclaimed Donna Felicita Margasanta, nicknamed the Magpie because of her continuous garrulity. "Aha!" repeated the other gossips. "And you hadn't thought of it? And you never noticed? And you don't know about Candia? We can tell you about Candia. Indeed, we can. Oh, yes, we can tell you about her. She washes clothes well, there's no denying it. She's the best laundress in Pescara, there's no question about it. But the trouble with her is that she's too light-fingered. Didn't you know that, my dear? She got a couple of towels from me once, and a napkin from me, and a nightgown from me, and 3 pairs of stockings from me, and a new petticoat from me, and I never got them back again, nor I, nor I. But I didn't discharge her. Whom could I get, Silvestra? Oh, oh, Angela Latonia, the African? Each one worse than the other. We must put up with it. But it's a spoon this time. That's a little too much. Don't you let it pass, Donna Christina. Don't you let it pass. Let it pass or not let it pass, burst forth Maria Bisaccia, who, in spite of her placid and benign appearance, never let an opportunity pass for displaying her superiority over her fellow servants. That is for us to decide, Donna Isabella. That is for us to decide. And the chatter continued to flow back and forth from windows to balcony, and the accusation spread from lip to lip throughout the whole countryside. 2. The following morning, Candia Marcanda already had her arms in a tub full of clothes when the village constable, Biagio Pesci, nicknamed the Little Corporal, appeared at her door. "His Honor the Mayor wants you up at his office right away," he told the laundress. "What's that?" demanded Candia, wrinkling her brows into a frown, yet without interrupting the task before her. "His Honor the Mayor wants you up at his office right away." "Wants me? What does he want me for?" Candia demanded rather sharply, for she was at a loss to understand this unexpected summons, and it turned her as stubborn as a horse balking at a shadow. "I can't tell you what for," replied the Little Corporal. "Those were my orders." "What were your orders?" From an obstinacy that was natural to her, she would not cease from answering questions. She could not convince herself that it was a reality. "The mayor wants me? What for? What have I done? I should like to know. I'm not going. I haven't done anything." The Little Corporal, losing his temper, answered, "Oh, you won't go, won't you? We'll see about that." And he went off muttering with his hand upon the hilt of the ancient sword he wore. Meanwhile, there were others along the narrow street who had overheard the conversation and came out upon their doorsteps, where they could watch Candia vigorously working her arms up and down in the tubful of clothes. And since they knew about the silver spoon, they laughed meaningly and interchanged ambiguous phrases, which Candia could not understand. But this laughter and those phrases awoke a vague foreboding in the woman's mind. And this foreboding gathered strength when the Little Corporal reappeared, accompanied by another officer. "Step lively," said the Little Corporal peremptorily. Candia wiped her arms without replying and went with them. In the public square, people stopped to look. One of her enemies, Rosa Panura, called out from the door of her shop with a hateful laugh, "Drop your stolen bone!" The laundress, dazed by this persecution for which she could find no reason, was at a loss for a reply. Before the mayor's office, a group of curious idlers had gathered to watch her as she went in. Candia, in an access of anger, mounted the steps in a rush and burst into the mayor's presence, breathlessly demanding, "Well, what is it you want of me?" Don Silla, a man of peaceful proclivities, was for the moment perturbed by the laundress's strident tones and cast a glance at the 2 faithful custodians of his official dignity. Then, taking a pinch of tobacco from his horn snuff-box, he said to her, "My daughter, be seated." But Candia remained standing. Her beak-like nose was inflated with anger, and her wrinkled cheeks quivered curiously. "Tell me, Don Silla, you went yesterday to take back the wash to Donna Christina La Monica? Well, and what of it? What of it? Was there anything missing? All of it counted piece by piece and not a thing missing. What's the matter with it now? Wait a moment, my daughter. In the same room there was a table silver. Candia, comprehending, turned like an angry hawk about to swoop upon its prey. Her thin lips twitched convulsively. The silver was in the room, and Donna Christina found that a spoon was missing. Do you understand, my daughter? Could you have taken it by mistake? Candia jumped like a grasshopper before the injustice of this accusation. As a matter of fact, she had stolen nothing. Oh, it was I, was it? Who says so? Who saw me? I am astonished at you, Don Silla. I am astonished at you. I, a thief? I? And there was no end to her indignation. She was all the more keenly stung by the unjust charge, because she knew herself to be capable of the action they attributed to her. "Then it was you who took it?" interrupted Don Silla, prudently sinking back into the depths of his spacious judicial chair. "I am astonished at you," snarled the woman once more, waving her long arms around as though they had been two sticks. "Very well, you may go. We will see about it." Candia went out without a salutation, blindly bumping into the doorpost. She had turned fairly green. She was beside herself. As she set foot in the street and saw the crowd which had gathered, she realized that already public opinion was against her, that no one was going to believe in her innocence. Nevertheless, she began to utter a vociferous denial. The crowd continued to laugh as it dispersed. Full of fury, she returned home and hopelessly began to weep upon her doorstep. Don Donato Brandamarte, who lived next door, said mockingly, "Cry louder! Cry louder! There are people passing by!" Since there were heaps of clothing still waiting for the suds, she finally calmed herself, bared her arms, and resumed her task. As she worked, she thought out her denials, elaborated a whole system of defense, sought out in her shrewd woman's brain an ingenious method of establishing her innocence, racking her brain for specious subtleties. She had recourse to every trick of rustic dialectic to construct a line of reasoning that would convince the most incredulous. Then, when her day's work was ended, she went out, deciding to go first to see Donna Christina. Donna Christina was not to be seen. It was Maria Bisaccia who listened to Candia's flood of words, shaking her head but answering nothing and withdrawing in dignified silence. Next, Candia made the circuit of all her clients. To each in turn she related the occurrence, to each she unfolded her defense, continually adding some new argument, amplifying her words, growing constantly more excited, more desperate, in the face of incredulity and distrust. And all in vain. She felt that from now on there was no further defense possible. A sort of blind hopelessness took possession of her. What more was there to do? What more was there to say? 3. Meanwhile, Donna Christina La Monica gave orders to send for Chinigua, a woman of the people who practiced magic and empirical medicine with considerable success. Chinigua had several times before discovered stolen goods, and it was said that she was secretly in league with the thieves. "Find that spoon for me," Donna Christina told her, "and you shall have a big reward." "Very well," Chinigua replied. 24 hours are all I need." And 24 hours later she brought back her answer. The spoon was to be found in a hole in the courtyard near the well. Donna Christina and Maria descended to the courtyard, made search, and to their great amazement found the spoon. Swiftly the news spread throughout Pescara. Then triumphantly Candia Marcanda went the rounds of all the streets. She seemed to have grown taller. She held her head erect. She smiled, looking everyone straight in the eye as if to say, "I told you so! I told you so!" The people in the shop, seeing her pass by, would murmur something and then break forth into a significantly sneering laugh. Filippo La Selvi, who sat drinking a glass of liqueur brandy in the Café d'Ange, called Candia in. "Another glass for Candia, the same as mine." The woman, who was fond of strong spirits, pursed up her lips covetously. "You certainly deserve it, there's no denying that," added Filippo La Selvi. An idle crowd had gathered in front of the café. They all had the spirit of mischief in their faces. While the woman drank, Filippo La Selvi turned and addressed his audience. "Say, she knew how to work it, didn't she? Isn't she the foxy one?" And he slapped the laundress familiarly upon her bony shoulder. The crowd laughed. A little dwarf called Magnafave, or Big Beans, weak-minded and stuttering, joined the forefinger of his right hand to that of his left, and, striking a grotesque attitude and dwelling upon each syllable, said, Ka-ka-ka-Candia, Ch-ch-Chinesia, and he continued to make gestures and to stammer forth vulgar witticisms, all implying that Candia and Chinigua were in league together. His spectators indulged in contortions of merriment. For a moment Candia sat there bewildered, with the glass still in her hand. Then in a flash she understood. They did not believe in her innocence. They accused her of having brought back the silver spoon secretly by agreement with the sorceress to save herself further trouble. An access of blind anger came upon her. Speechless with passion, she flung herself upon the weakest of them, upon the little hunchback, in a hurricane of blows and scratches, and the crowd at the sight of this struggle formed a circle and jeered at them in cruel glee, as at a fight between two animals, and egged on the two combatants with voice and gesture. Big Beans, badly scared by her unexpected violence, tried to escape, hopping about like a little ape, and held fast by the laundress's terrible arms, whirled round and round with increasing velocity like a stone in a sling, until at last he fell violently upon his face. Some of the men hastened to pick him up. Candia withdrew in the midst of hisses, shut herself within her house, and flung herself across her bed, sobbing and gnawing her fingers in the keenness of her suffering. The new accusation cut her deeper than the first, and all the more that she knew herself capable of such a subterfuge. How was she to clear herself now? How was she to establish the truth? She grew hopeless as she realized that she could not allege in defense any material difficulties that might have interfered with carrying out the deception. Access to the courtyard was perfectly simple. A door, that was never fastened, opened from the ground floor of the main stairway. People came and went freely through that door to remove the garbage or for other causes. So it was impossible for her to close the lips of her accusers by saying, "How could I have got in?" The means of successfully carrying out such a plan were many and easy. Candia proceeded to conjure up new arguments to convince them. She sharpened up her wits. She invented 3, 4, 5 different cases to prove that the spoon never could have been found in that hole in the courtyard. She split hairs with marvelous ingenuity. Next, she took to making the rounds of the shops and the houses, seeking in very possible way to overcome the people's incredulity. They listened to her, greatly entertained by her captious reasoning, and they would end by saying, "Oh, it's all right." But there was a certain tone in their voice that left Candia annihilated. So then all her trouble was for nothing. No one would believe her. Yet with marvelous persistence she would return to the attack, spending whole nights in thinking out new arguments. And little by little, under this continued strain, her mind gave way. She could no longer follow any sustained thought but that of the silver spoon. Neglecting her work, she had sunk to a state of actual want. When she went down to the river bank under the iron bridge, where the other washwomen congregated, she would sometimes let slip from between her fingers the garments that the current swept away forever, and she would talk continually, unweariedly, of the one single subject. In order not to hear her, the young laundresses would begin to sing and would mock her with the improvised rhymes of their songs, and she meanwhile would shout and gesticulate like a crazy woman. No one could give her work any longer. Out of pity, some of her former employers would send her food. Little by little she fell into the habit of begging, and wandered through the streets, bowed over, unkempt, and all in rags. The street urchins would tag behind her, shouting, "Tell us the story of the spoon, 'cause we never heard it, Auntie Candia." She would stop strangers sometimes as they passed by to tell them the story and to argue out her defense. Young fellows would sometimes send for her and pay her a copper to tell it all over, 2, 3, or 4 times. They would raise up difficulties against her arguments. They would hear her all the way through, and then at last stab her with a final word. She would shake her head and go on her way. She found companionship among other beggars and would reason with them endlessly, indefatigably, invincibly. Her chosen friend was a deaf woman whose skin was a mass of angry blotches and who limped on one leg. In the winter of 1874, she was at last stricken with serious illness. The woman with the blotches cared for her. Donna Christina LaMonica sent her a cordial and a scuttle of coals. The sick woman lying on her pallet still raved of the silver spoon. She would raise herself on her elbow and struggle to wave her arm to give emphasis to her fevered arguments. And at the last, when her staring eyes already seemed overspread with the veil of troubled waters that rose from within, Candia gasped forth, "It wasn't I, madam, because you see, the spoon." And that story was The End of Candia by Gabriele D'Annunzio from Great Short Stories of the World, edited by Lois Hill. And now from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44 from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. The White Orchard by Arthur C. Under a supermoon, you gaze into the orchard. A glassblower shapes a glowing orange mass into a horse. You step into a space where you once lived. Crushed mica glitters on plastered walls. A raccoon strolls in moonlight along the top of an adobe wall. Swimming in a pond, we notice a reflected cottonwood on the water. Clang! A deer leaps over the gate. Every 15 minutes, an elephant is shot for its tusks. You mark a bleached, earless lizard against the snowfall of this white page, the skins of eggplants glistening in a garden, our bodies glistening by firelight. Though skunks once ravaged corn, our bright moments cannot be ravaged. Sleeping near a canal, you hear lapping waves. At dawn, waves lapping and the noise of men unloading scallops and shrimp. No noise of gunshots. You focus on the branches of 100-year-old apple trees. Opening the door, we find red and yellow rose petals scattered on our bed. Then, light years, you see pear branches farther in the orchard as the moon rises, branches bending under the snow of this white page. And that was The White Orchard by Arthur C. from Pushcart Prize, Volume 44 from the year 2020, edited by Bill Henderson. That's the end of our Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program for today. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me. If you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio.